You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Andre Whao oso toku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. It's good to be back. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday, everybody. I'm your host, Andre, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Joining me in the studio is producer Arno. FR Kene, coming up on the show. I speak to Morgan Theakston, a spokesperson from World Vision, about their campaign and petition calling for the government to implement policies that can put an end to modern-day slavery. Amelia speaks to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the party's annual general meeting that they held over the weekend. Arno, what have you got for us today?
I speak to First Union organiser Justin Wallace about their negotiations for better pay for frame and truss workers. And I speak to MBA student and business owner Joel Sterling about his experience as an MBA and meeting Richard Branson.
Thank you for that, Arno. He aha o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so please get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. Ko ā e ware ware e hei ana koutou te whakanoo ki ēnei, korero anō he Pākihere, roki roki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. And with that, let's get to the Wednesday Wire.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Here at the university over the weekend, the Green Party held their annual general meeting where they revealed their manifesto to voters ahead of this year's election. To discuss the meeting and the party's policy announcements, Amelia Sullivan spoke to Green Party co-leader James Shaw and started by asking him how he'd describe the party's manifesto and whether they are taking any different approaches to previous years.
I would describe the manifesto as bold and also achievable within the next term of Parliament. So what we've laid out, you know, we get asked for our positions on all manner of things that are of interest to people in the run-up to the election, and we feel it's fair to let people know what our positions on those things are. So that's the purpose of the manifesto.
At this HUI AGM, you announced some policies, some big and some small. I first just wanted to start with your pledge to establish a standalone Ministry of Climate Change. Mm. Why do you think this is necessary, and what would it achieve that other ministries aren't at the moment?
Well, so the role of the Ministry for the Environment has changed enormously in the 6 years that we've been in government when it comes to climate change. And climate change, as a result of the work that we have done in government, is now a all-of-government problem with about 20 different ministries who have all got, you know, different tasks and projects that are assigned to them. And so what we need really is something more akin to a central agency, a bit like Treasury or the Public Service Commission, which helps to coordinate the action right across government. And I've always been a fan of much more focused ministries with really clear missions. And I think that having a standalone ministry for climate change will help to achieve that.
Your speech at the AGM discussed how the Greens wanted to create what you called a less bad future. Is less bad ambitious enough, or is this just kind of a realistic take on the situation given the hand that's been dealt?
Well, I think at this point it's pretty obvious to most New Zealanders, and in particular people in Tamaki Makaurau, that we are already facing a future with increasing storms, floods, droughts, fires, and so on. And at this point, that is going to continue because of all of the pollution that we've put into the atmosphere over the last couple of hundred years, which is still up there. And every single tenth of a degree, every fraction of a degree of temperature increase matters. And so what I'm saying is that, you know, we need to double down on stopping that pollution from going into the atmosphere that's going to add to the problem and make it worse.
You and your co-leader, Marama Davidson, were both re-elected as co-leaders of the Green Party at this AGM. This is quite different from last year when you were briefly ousted from your position. Do you think that this united front will, I guess, overshadow some of the less favourable situations the party has found itself in this year?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would have to say I thought the mood at the conference was buoyant. It was very focused. there's a level of determination to ensure that we get a third term in government and that we can finish the project that we started when we first got elected in 2017.
And the Greens' internal polling says that one in three voters are pretty keen on your party's policy. However, this isn't particularly translating into the same level of support as we've been seeing in the polls. Is this of any concern to you?
Well, the number of people who have considered voting Green has bounced around between 25 and 30% of the population for most of the last decade. And so we know that there is a, you know, there's a large group of people who are at the very least open to voting Green. The whole point of the election campaign is to convince as many of those people as possible to actually do so. Now, our on average, our polling is higher than where it was at the 2020 election. And that was higher than where it was in the 2017 election. So what that shows is that we are steadily increasing our support. And I think that that is because people look at the work that we are doing in government and recognise the value that we add here. And, you know, do I want more? Then absolutely, every political leader of every political party does. And we'll be working very hard over the course of the next 12 weeks of the election campaign to make that argument to people.
So how do you go about appealing to these voters who think you've got good ideas but aren't necessarily committed to voting Green without compromising on your values?
Well, I think that if you look at the track record that we have established in government, what we have been able to do with the governments that we have been kind of handed, if you like, by the voters, I think it's frankly nothing short of remarkable. We have always said that we want to go further and faster than we have been able to, and I think at this election we've got a real opportunity to elect the most progressive government that this country has had in generations. But that will only happen if we've got more Green MPs in Parliament and therefore more Green ministers sitting around the Cabinet table in the next government.
Yeah, and on that note, when you reflect on your partnership with the Labor Party over the past 6 years, are you happy with the deal you got and the progress that's been made on climate action, or would you be asking for more if you had the opportunity to form government later this year?
We absolutely would be asking for more if we have the opportunity to form a government later this year. And like I said, I mean, I think that we have had a constructive working relationship with Labor, but it is determined by the numbers in Parliament. You know, the fact is that in 2020, they got an outright majority. They don't need our votes to pass legislation in the House. We did come to the arrangement where Marta and I are ministers as part of this government, but we are outside Cabinet. If the numbers were different, if we had more Green MPs in Parliament, that would translate to both more Green ministers, but also sitting in Cabinet. And that would really help us to shape the overall direction of policy in the next government.
That was Amelia Sullivan talking to Green Party co-leader James Shaw.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
New Zealand Frame and Trust are undergoing collective bargaining to try and strike a fair balance between work and pay. First Union believes workers are being underpaid and they are struggling to make ends meet. The company, a subsidiary of Fletcher's Building, is paying its workers close to minimum wage while executives make hundreds of thousands of dollars annually. I started my interview with First Union organizer Justin Wallace by asking how Frame and Truss functions as a business.
Okay, so what they do is that they do the framing and trussing for new homes. So the likes of Fletcher's, who would have these residential developments, the Frame and Truss guys, they just do the wooden frames and trusses for those homes, set them up at a kit set sort of model, they get thrown on the back of the trucks, sent out to the building sites and then whacked on up.
Why are Frame and Truss workers unable to reach an agreement in the course of bargaining with management?
I think there's a couple of factors here. I think the first one is that the company, I believe, with what's been happening with the cost of living, also what's been happening with how the company is itself, as in Fletcher's. Remember, Placemakers is a subsidiary of Fletcher's, so Fletcher's look at themselves firstly as one big brand, but then they also have these subsidiaries and Placemakers are a part of that. What they tend to do is look at things individually and see how they work as a subsidiary. And at the moment, Placemakers are going through, particularly in the Frame and Truss side, where they're going through a bit of a downward turn in regards to competition from other companies that are doing the similar stuff. and also the slight downturn in regards to the building sector. That shouldn't really have any effect on the membership with their bargaining, because we started this bargaining at the beginning of the year, slightly before that. But I think the procrastinating's been is that the business as a whole has been trying to figure out the best way to make sure that they get a profit back on whatever they're doing for their work, and trying to make sure that what they're paying the workers doesn't affect their profit.
What does First Union hope to achieve for Frame and Truss workers?
A reasonable pay increase. I mean, these workers have families to support, they have rents to pay, some of them mortgages to pay, they've got children to feed. The cost of living, particularly in the Auckland region with where these guys work, and I mean, it's happening around the country, but, you know, these guys are struggling. I'm getting phone calls and from texts and emails from members saying, look, we need to try and get this finalised because it's really starting to affect me. And the way this is starting to affect them is simply with simple things like last night I went out and went and got some groceries, and a cabbage now is $9. You know, I mean, these guys are really struggling. And it's unfortunate that the company don't seem to see that, or even in some respects care about that. It just seems to be about profit, seems to be about what the shareholder can retain. And it also, from the way I look at it, it also seems to be about to make sure that the top-level management can get their wages, because I guarantee you those guys have had their percentage increases, and I can guarantee you that those individuals aren't struggling to make sure they can put food on the table.
Are the wages for Frame and Truss workers in line with inflation and the heightened cost of living?
No.
How will the heightened cost of living affect the livelihoods of underpaid Frame and Truss workers?
Oh, well, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like with that ad that's on TV at the moment. It's going to affect their families, particularly how they can support their families, particularly how they can feed their children and look after themselves. You know, this is going to have a monumental effect. These guys, you know, they work hard. You know, when the work's on, they work hard. And for some of them, it could be their sole income. For others, they may have partners who are working. Most of the people that I'm aware of that are in this community around where they work, you know, they've got both mum and dad that are working hard to try and make sure that they can support their families and look after their families and put a roof over their heads. And with where these guys are at now, it's becoming really difficult. It's really got to the point now where I'm starting to worry how some of these people are surviving, and whether there's now a more of a look at going to loan sharks and on high interest just to be able to get extra money coming in so they can support their families.
I read that the CEO of Fletcher's has the second highest income of any New Zealand CEO. Has the pay of management executives been affected as well, or are they doing well for themselves?
Well, I think you've answered your own question. He's the second highest paid CEO. Most of those board members are, you know, they're making in the hundreds of thousands, and some of them close to the $1 million a year. To be clear, the CEO, to my knowledge, I've never seen him hold a hammer or a shovel or do anything in regards to what's happening on his sites. So I think he's very well paid. In fact, when you look at what the rest of his workforce, particularly those men and women that are doing the mahi to make sure that he can make the second highest wage of a CEO in the country does, I think he's doing pretty well.
Yeah, I also read that the workers were earning somewhere between $23.50 an hour, so that's quite appalling. Now, what are the next steps for ensuring an equitable pay for Frame and Truss workers?
So as of this morning, we received a terms of settlement offer that I'm going to be going and putting to the membership this afternoon. Whether the local media that sort of has created this story has pushed them to the point where they now realise they've got to put a terms of settlement to us, I'm not too sure, but it's good now that this morning I'm going to be able to go through that this afternoon, have a conversation with the membership and see whether they're willing to accept it or not, and let's see how they go with that vote and decision that they make.
That was First Union organiser Justin Wallace on the collective bargaining negotiations with NZ Frame and Truss.
Thank you for that, Pisano. We'll be right back after this quick song break. Keep it here on the B.
some soul. Give me your silence, watching me walk out the door. Yeah, I'ma take my time and do what I got to do.
Be a family. What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
You're right. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Botico Beats with Juliana Sion, Timothy Nolia and guests.
And tomorrow,
Kamal and Chapters.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, is back for 2023. The world's best filmmakers are bringing their latest creations to Aotearoa. From major award winners and nominees to creations from our very own soil, this is the perfect opportunity to see some truly excellent films. Grab yourself a festival guide from participating venues and create your ultimate NZIFF experience. Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, July 19th to August 6th. Tickets and info available at nziff.co.nz.
What's his title? The guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Brimson.
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. We'd love to hear your thoughts on any of the pieces that have come up so far, so please get in touch. Tuku Pātuhi Mai, text on 5395, or Wai Mai Rānei, give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. This week, humanitarian agencies in New Zealand released an open letter to the government calling for legislation on modern-day slavery. World Vision and Tear Fund are calling for the government to roll out legislation that requires businesses to assess where modern-day slavery may be used in their supply chains domestically and globally. It is estimated by World Vision that around 50 million people are in modern-day slavery, with around 27 million experiencing forced labour, with a large number in the Asia Pacific. Consumer goods imported into New Zealand are often direct products of modern slavery. To talk more about the policy recommendations that World Vision is pushing for and the wider issue of modern-day slavery in New Zealand and the Asia Pacific, I spoke to Morgan Theakston, Advocacy, Campaigns and Communications Manager at World Vision. Morgan, from your knowledge, how expansive is the issue of migrant exploitation in New Zealand and globally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that exploitation is a major issue, both globally and in New Zealand. And migrants are one of the most vulnerable people groups, particularly if it's a person coming from a position of poverty, and also due to visa constraints and needing a visa to work and be protected under employment standards. So to start with, globally, 50 million people are in modern slavery, and 28 million of those are trapped in forced labor, and some of those people are making the products that we actually buy right here in New Zealand. In New Zealand, migrant exploitation is a big issue in a variety of industries, so we know that it's found in the agricultural industry and viticulture, so through winemaking and vineyards, in construction, hospitality, and we know that there are a lot of complaints about it. So between 2021 and 2022, the government received over 1,000 complaints to the Migrant Exploitation Worker Hotline. And sadly, only 90% of those were even followed up with an investigation. So we know it's a huge issue and we need to take more action to address it.
So how rife is the exploitation of Pacific and Asian migrants here in New Zealand? And at what level is this happening?
New Zealand relies a lot on seasonal workers. And the majority of these workers are men and women who migrate from South and East Asia and the Pacific. The seasonal worker scheme visa ties migrant workers to their jobs. You can see how this could cause issues. This increases vulnerability to exploitation and being taken advantage of. We know that it's relatively common for migrant workers to be recruited by a New Zealander who may go to the Pacific, find someone, offer to loan them money for their travel, for their visa, and then the person gets here and finds they're working these insanely long hours, they're not paid what they were promised, their passport may be taken by the employer, which then restricts their movement, and then there's astronomical interest on their original loan, so they can't leave until they work enough to pay it off, but the way that it's set up is they can never actually pay it off, and this is a form of modern slavery called debt bondage. And we know that employers will use intimidation tactics and false information about immigration laws to make it so people don't feel comfortable seeking help.
What steps is World Vision calling for in order to put an end to modern-day slavery?
So our goal is to make sure that the products New Zealand imports and makes aren't made using modern slavery, and ultimately to inspire a new way of doing business in New Zealand that prioritizes people over profit. So World Vision has spent the past few years calling for modern slavery legislation alongside some of our partners, and this would require businesses to look into their supply chains, which is all of the factories and people overseas that are involved in making their products, to assess the risks of modern slavery and to really take action to address those risks. We want businesses to be held accountable for making sure that the people making their products are treated with dignity and rewarded fairly. And there's already been heaps of work done on this. In 2021, 37,000 Kiwis signed a petition calling for this law. The government held a public consultation on their legislative proposal where 90% of Kiwis supported the law. And then the government in later last year said they'd introduce this law in this term of government, but the election's nearing and we haven't seen the progress that we're promised. So right now we're just doing everything we can to push the government to progress this ahead of the election.
Wouldn't any potential policies that the government could bring on only have a potential domestic impact rather than on international work standards from our import partners?
So how we do business in New Zealand has a huge impact on working conditions in the countries we import products from. So New Zealand businesses have contracts with suppliers overseas who are making the products, so farming raw materials, manufacturing the finished goods that they then import and sell back to New Zealand. And they are the ones placing the orders, and they have influence. They have a level of influence to set the expectation for working conditions and can get involved with suppliers to make sure that workers are being treated fairly. There are tons of actions that they can take that we know have positive impacts. So to start, most businesses don't actually know where their products are being made. So they can start by tracing their supply chains to find out where these factories are, where these people are working. They can conduct anonymous worker surveys to get a better understanding of working conditions and work with suppliers to address concerns. Businesses can make sure that the way they're purchasing is responsible, for example, that their turnaround times on orders aren't going to place massive pressure on workers overseas, which means they then have to work crazy long hours, and sometimes employers will resort to using forced labor because it's unpaid and it's extra work. And there are businesses who are already taking these actions voluntarily and seeing positive impact. So we know that a policy that requires all businesses to act will have a huge effect. And I think it's important to note that, you know, while this law won't directly change employment standards in other countries, it does help to drive higher business standards and expectations globally, especially when it comes to setting business expectations for trade agreements between countries.
What are some of the things that we can do to support the movement, but also recognize where modern slavery has played a role in our lives?
I think it's really important to recognize how much we're connected to modern day slavery through the things that we buy. You know, it's all around us. It's in our clothing, footwear, our food, our coffee, our electronics. But at the same time, the burden of changing an entire system, an entire way of doing business cannot be on us as consumers. So it's really the government that can make this change. So while we, of course, can always make more informed purchasing decisions, I think that we should let, you know, the bulk of our energy should be directed at the government. And a major way that people can support progressing this legislation right now is to sign our open letter calling on the government to progress legislation before the election. So World Vision and Tear Fund have teamed up to create an open letter and a video, and you can either go to the advocacy page on World Vision's website, or you can go directly to actionstation.org.nz and search modern slavery legislation, and our open letter will come up. And what we're trying to do with this is just to show the government that Kiwis still want this legislation, and hopefully we can move them to action.
That was Morgan Theakston, Advocacy Campaigns and Communications Manager at World Vision, talking to me about modern-day slavery. And as Morgan said at the end of the piece, you can visit the World Vision website to view the open letter and the video that they did in partnership with Tear Fund.
95 BFM.
You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
Tira ara yang dapat anda katakan. Kamu tidak bisa berubah pikiran. Aku tidak percaya.
Gazed at the seemingly never-ending landscape of the sky, wondering just what might be beyond planet Earth? Uncover its mysteries and magnitude this month with Tūhura Tuarangi, Aotearoa in Space.
Learn and play with out-of-this-world activities that showcase space technology and the world-leading research going on right here in Aotearoa.
Get your hands crafting and mind sharpening with fun and facts for the whole whānau.
Play, build, launch and explore the origins of our night sky this July at MOTAT. Find out more at motat.nz.
Need something to get you back into the groove of the university grind?
Yes.
Some reorientation to crank out those essays and APA reference documents?
Yes.
Check this out.
BFM's got you covered with 95 BFM DJs at Shadows this Rio Week thanks to Ice Cold Jägermeister. Head down to Shadows for the best event this Rio Week. Get in amongst fun games like foosball and sub-soccer and be in to win heaps of Jägermeister merch and other sweet prizes. All while BFM's finest DJs provide only the best of banging tunes. Save the night with Jägermeister and 95 BFM at Shadows. Friday, July 21st from 5 to 10pm.
You're back on The Wire on 95 BFM. Here's a piece from Arno.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Business owner and University of Auckland student Joel Sterling had the opportunity to meet entrepreneur Sir Richard Branson at a conference this year. He shares the nuggets of wisdom imparted upon him and talks about his experience as an MBA student, as well as the several chess games he played with Branson. I started our interview by asking him how the meeting with Branson came about.
Okay, so what they do is that they do the framing and trussing for new homes. So the likes of Fletcher's, who would have these residential developments, the frame and truss guys, they just do the wooden frames and trusses for those homes, set them up at a kit set sort of model, they get thrown on the back of the trucks, sent out to the building sites and then whacked on up.
Why are frame and truss...
Apologies, that was a quick technical difficulty. We'll go to a song break and we'll play Arno's piece. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
That was Prosecco Gold by Armamelia. We'll try that bit again, eh, Arno?
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Business owner and University of Auckland student Joel Sterling had the opportunity to meet entrepreneur Sir Richard Branson at a conference this year. He shares the nuggets of wisdom imparted upon him and talks about his experience as an MBA student, as well as the several chess games he played with Branson. I started our interview by asking him how the meeting with Branson came about.
He told me about this event about 3 years ago and asked if I wanted to come along, but obviously it was postponed due to COVID. And then the opportunity popped up again this year, and I said yes straight away.
What were the key things you learnt from Branson?
Well, he's dyslexic and I'm dyslexic, so it sort of gave me the courage to use that as a superpower, is what he calls it, and to use it to your advantage and then master the arts of delegation, so delegating off work that I know that is my weak points to people is obviously their strong points, which is anything to do with like writing and stuff like that, or anything that dyslexia hinders, essentially.
What would you say is the most important thing Branson told you?
That's a good one, actually. He said, say yes first, and then ask what the question is second. So essentially, if you're presented with a good idea or an opportunity, just jump on it, say yes, and then work it out as you go, essentially.
When you attended One Future, this convention we're talking about, did you learn anything interesting about AI and blockchain, and can you share?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is the future, artificial intelligence and also blockchain. If you're not utilizing it now, you're essentially going to get left behind very quickly because it's moving so fast. And all the government agencies are all starting to use blockchain as well with IDs and accounts and stuff like that as well. So it's a powerful tool. And also, if you're not going to utilize it, you can't expect to be left behind in business.
What is your own business and how did it get to where it is now?
I'm importing and distributing at the moment. So I've got a company called Soup Distribution. And Soup is called is for supplier of unique products. So essentially just drop shipping and importing and distribution in New Zealand and around the globe.
What sort of products?
Automotive products at the moment, but it can be anything and everything, basically just anything that I find is unique and I like and catches my eye, but I am looking to get into other areas and I've got a new startup kicking start right now.
Well, can you tell us a bit about your startup?
Using technology at the moment, and a little bit hard to say, but essentially I'm going to be providing every New Zealander with unlimited free power for their devices.
Fantastic. Now, would you recommend the University of Auckland MBA program to young entrepreneurs?
Oh, absolutely. So I would say I was the only entrepreneurial person in the class, whereas the majority you will find a quite corporate type. But I went into the MBA knowing that if I could learn just one thing that would help me to grow my business or to find a new idea, and if that paid for itself for the course paper, that'll be worth it. And yeah, absolutely did find that. So I would highly recommend it. It's a lot of hard work.
How many years was your course?
An 18-month course. Class is already second weekend.
I read that you played chess with Richard Branson. Who won the most games?
We played 4 games of chess over 4 days. He won every game, but they were extremely close games, very, very close games. So, yeah, as well as, I didn't feel too bad losing to a real knight, Sir Richard Branson. So, but challenging, it was awesome. It was a highlight of the whole event.
That was MBA student Joel Sterling on starting his own business and meeting with Sir Richard Branson.
That was The Wire.
Koera te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa i kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire, everybody. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Green Party co-leader James Shaw, Morgan Theakston, Communications Campaigns and Communications Manager at World Vision, First Unions Justin Wallace, and MBA student from the University of Auckland. And thanks to Arno and Amelia for producing their pieces today. Nā rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we have the 1-4 with Bridge. But until then, stay tuned. Have a great week, everybody.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.